In 1803, Lewis and Clark followed the Missouri River up into the Rocky Mountains. A few summers back, my friend Joseph Verbanek and I covered that same route on bicycles. I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices from NPR. For the next hour, we're on the Lewis and Clark Trail. I'm thumbing through the letters of the Lewis and Clark expedition, all the correspondence before they left, before they started writing their journals. The most famous one is right here, 1803, Jefferson's Instructions to Lewis. All the Lewis and Clark buffs know that one. And Dan Buckvich, a composer, he used the words in a symphony.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River.
They were looking for a water passage that would connect the Mississippi with the Pacific, so you could sail from Europe to Asia through North America, making the United States a center of trade and ridiculously wealthy.
In order to determine which course might offer the most direct and practical water route across this continent to the Pacific Ocean.
No one owned the West yet. And other countries wanted just as much to control any new trade routes. So for security, Jefferson told Lewis to encode their communication. Here's a chart of letters which use a keyword to encrypt a message. The sample keyword is artichokes. The message? I am at the head of the Missouri, all well, and the Indians so far friendly. They say the Apollo astronauts knew more about the moon than Lewis and Clark knew about their destination. So the captains had every fur trader and Indian they met tell them what they could. My friend Joe and I are bicycling the Lewis and Clark Trail this summer. And we have Kathy down at the local AAA office.
St. Louis, and you're going to go...
We're going to end up in Fort Mandan, which is about 40 miles north of Bismarck and Mandan.
Oh, it is?
The Fort Mandan Historical Site.
Okay,
where Lewis and Clark had their winter camp.
Oh, that'll be cool. And you're going to go along the river here?
Along the Missouri.
Wow.
Actually, that's the Mississippi.
I'm just basically going to input into the computer the route along the river as close as I can get it. Uh-huh. And that way you'll know the distance in the that you'll be traveling in each state that you go through.
Jefferson instructed Lewis to take all his scientific observations with great pains and accuracy. Here's 2 pages of astronomical formula for calculating longitude and latitude. And here's a page of questions that Dr. Benjamin Rush had for Meriwether Lewis to ask. What are the acute diseases of the Indians? Is the bilious fever ever attended with a black vomit? Is goiter, apoplexy, palsy, epilepsy, madness, venereal disease known among them? The good Dr. Rush had 11 rules of health for the men. Flannel should be worn constantly next to the skin, especially in wet weather. The less spirits you use, the better. The captains ignored that one. And Joe and I will also ignore it.
What is the tank? This is the Winnebago Reservation.
Oh, we could put that in there.
Winnebago, then Sioux City.
Lewis made a checklist of everything he was going to bring with him. A long list of Indian presents. 5 pounds of white wampum. 5 pounds of white glass beads. 50 pounds spun tobacco. Their means of transportation. 1 keeled boat, light, strong, at least 60 feet in length, her burden equal to 8 tons. 1 iron frame of canoe, 40 feet long. 1 large wooden canoe. And medicine, 15 pounds powdered bark, 12 ounces opium, 4 pewter penis syringes. That's what it says.
So that's our end point.
Okay, I'll go ahead and print this out. This might take a while because there's a lot on here.
And if you read the journals, the mission of the expedition was for politics, economics, diplomacy, science, but really, for me at least, as soon as they left St. Louis, it was just a long, hard walk in the woods by some pretty talented woodsmen. Joe and I like to be outside, too, and we're kind of wondering what we've done with the woods and the waterways and the prairies and the towns in the past couple hundred years.
Wow, you guys are going to be, like, going 1,581 miles.
On a bike?
On a bike.
Oh, jeez.
And if you're driving, it'd take you 32.28 hours.
How long is this going to take you?
Six weeks.
If it was me, it'd take 6 months.
6 weeks, that's all.
We budget ourselves 50 miles a day.
50 miles a day.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River in order to determine which course might offer the most direct and practical water route across the continent to the Pacific Ocean. In all your interaction with the natives, treat them in the most friendly manner.
Mike, shortstop! Allen, second base!
Hey, you keep the ball and throw it.
As soon as these people go home, Joe and I are going to camp here. Marthasville, Missouri, population 800. Half of them are down here eating hot dogs and cheering their little leaguers. The first game, Lemke Trenching and Excavating versus Miller Funeral Homes.
Hey, Johnny, come get the gear on.
We started our trip this afternoon in St. Charles, pedaled 40 miles, a short day for us. The Lewis and Clark expedition took 4 days to travel that same distance. They got here May 25, 1804. Captain Clark wrote, camped at the mouth of a creek called La Charette, above a small French village of 7 houses and as many families. Settled at this place to be convenient to hunt and trade with the Indians. This is the last settlement of whites. Well, there's a few more houses here now, but when the buildings in downtown Marthasville come up for sale, FEMA buys them. It's cheaper than rebuilding every time the Missouri River floods, which it does often. The community center here is made of cement to withstand the floodwaters. They just move everything upstairs, and the river flows right through a big opening in the middle of the first floor, a 12-foot-high, 20-foot-wide walkway. It was designed by Don Sherman, a retired Chrysler worker. Now he's volunteer caretaker at the ballpark.
I've been with the program for 30 years, so most of all these kids out here that's playing, I've coached their fathers in the Little League program. But this is one of the older towns in Missouri. It was founded in 1817. Right now, the town is just getting less every year because the floods came through in 93 and 95. All the businesses had about 3 feet of water standing in them. And right here where we're standing, it was 10.5 feet of water. From about halfway out in that field to halfway up that backstop was just trash. Corn stalks, trees, weeds. And we scooped it all up with dozers and dumped it on trucks and hauled it away.
That night it rains. In the morning, Loretta, at Loretta's Bar and Grill, tells us it's been raining for weeks. The river rose 4 feet in just the past 24 hours, and more water's on the way.
What is that, you know? Is it bugs? Frogs?
Three days out, the river is now 10 feet above flood stage. Critters are crawling all over the trail. Turtles, snakes, and worms. A million worms. All trying to get out of the floodwaters. The river is crawling up the trail, too, and pretty soon it's over the trail, and we're pedaling through water. Fish are rising right next to us. Turkey buzzards are fishing above our head. We're in the Missouri River.
Look out.
We pass swollen swamps, people out catfishing with rods and spears. We pass Eric Hazlett, who's also bicycling through the water. He's pulling a big metal bike trailer, which he's just about filled with buckets and buckets of night crawlers.
You know, I was down, like, there's maybe 6 miles from here, and there's, like, a swampy thing, and there was all kinds of noise coming out of it. I don't know if it was insects or what. Do you know what that was?
Oh, yeah, some old tree frogs. They was it loud?
Really loud?
Yeah, tree frogs. Well, yesterday, boy, you can hear that. They just croaking like crazy. I do a lot of fishing in the river. I caught one yesterday, weighed about 30 pounds. I ride down here about 25 miles from my bicycle, way down here, go fishing a week or two or three at a time. Drink a lot of beer.
Where do you stay?
Right on the river.
Just camp out?
Yeah, I got my tarp and everything else.
So you just bring a tarp with you?
Yeah. It's a lot easier than a tent to me. I said, tent, you fight and fool on them poles and stuff. I can have that tarp up in no time. I just like to fish. I'm just a country person. I guess it's all in my... just the way I like living, I guess.
A few miles up the trail are two guys standing in a bean field, bow fishing. They have bows with arrows attached to fishing line and reels. Fish from the Missouri River have followed the floodwaters into what's now this pond in the middle of this farmer's field. Big fish, 2 to 4 foot gar and carp, which these guys will chop later into bait to catch even bigger catfish.
Did you see all them worms that was up on the pavement? That's a big reason why they're coming in here, getting them worms, and they're just feeding on them. I mean, they're under the water like crazy. Here's one right here.
Need another arrow?
Damn, that's a good one there. Pardon my French. Look, that is a big gar. I got him on the way out. Boy, what a shot, too. That was right in the spine. That's a doozer. That's a fighter, man. That's one of my biggest ones. But what we was doing was trying to get here today. They say it's going to crest. And as soon as it crests, some fish, they seem to know that, and they start going back out to deeper water. So we wanted to hit them today before they moved out.
So you're saying these fish, like, this doesn't faze them. This isn't a big mistake coming in.
Oh, no. No, not at all. Yeah, this is just a main pathway for the water when it floods. A lot of these fish, they've probably been through here the same way in 93 when it flooded. This isn't their first rodeo. They're used to all this stuff. That's the whole reason they're here, just to feed. Everything is. When it floods, I mean, they got more food than they could ever imagine. They're just scavenging, doing their best they can to eat all they can. But the majority of them, I think, will make it out, unless we get them all today, which I doubt we will.
That's why you're here, too, to feed. Right?
That's right. That's right. It all goes to a purpose. It's a food chain. I mean, hopefully they'll put a big catfish on my trot line.
Up that direction. Something moved your way.
Captain Clark, May 30th, 1804. Set out at 6 o'clock after a heavy shower and proceeded on. The current, very swift, river rising fast. A little after dark last night, several guns were heard below. I expect the Frenchmen firing for White House, who was lost in the woods. We made 14 miles today. The country on each side appear full of water. When Joe and I get to Jefferson City, both the way we'd come and the way we want to go are fenced off with a trail close sign saying, "Do not continue. You may become stranded with no escape route." So we divert north to Columbia. We decide to get a hotel and dry our gear. As we unpack, we unleash all kinds of Missouri River critters from our dip in the stream. There's things crawling and flying around the room. Joe squeezes a welt on his arm, and a tiny red mite comes out. We're our own traveling ecosystem. The pieces of the river we brought with us are busy settling into their new home. You are hearing voices on the Lewis and Clark Trail from Missouri to Montana.
Well, they start off by, Lewis starts off by saying, "We are about to penetrate a country 2,000 miles in width, where the foot of civilized man has never trod." So it's very, this is very, you can hear the rhythmic dun da 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 da, that kind of a feeling, which goes along with their excitement for going out into this new land.
"We are about to penetrate a country 2,000 miles in width, where the foot of civilized man has never trod."
Columbia, a college town, which means good coffee, good beer, and a chance to talk to Eric Dillner of the University Music Department. He's producing an opera about Lewis and Clark.
What's exciting about using opera for this is that we can stop and really expand one moment. And opera has these pieces of music called arias. And an aria is one person singing about their feeling about that moment. This is Lewis sings, write it down, get it right, every little detail, day and night. Take some notes, don't delay. All the world is waiting for what you say. So they're trying to figure out what every detail means, and what I think they can really see that 200 years from that day, people are going to be looking back at what they did as something important. They knew.
We are anxious to proceed.
So, let's see if I can dirty my gun. You guys ready for some noise? Fire in the hole.
Late Friday afternoon, we pedal back to the Missouri to catch a Lewis and Clark festival in Rocheport. Only a few hundred people live in Rocheport, but today there's a few thousand walking the small downtown, listening to music, to reenactors, and to historical presentations. I catch up with one of the presenters, Jim Harlan, a University of Missouri geographer. He's using 1815 land office survey notes to map the Missouri Territory of two centuries ago.
Today's river is what, 14 foot deep, something like that, and a half mile wide. Well, that river back then was mile, mile and a half, 2 miles wide, and 4 foot deep, full of sand, cottonwood trees, and islands. That keelboat, well, that's the reason they wound up dragging that thing to Montana. It was because they had a hell of a time trying to find deep enough water where they could sail openly. I started looking at the notes, and there's a lot more information in there. There's cultural information. They're running into all sorts of flora, fauna, Indians, wildlife, cougars, because these guys had to walk those straight survey lines, right? And when they ran into a she-cat with cubs, they couldn't go around her. They had to go right through her. And so that would make the cat mad, and the cat would stalk them for days at a time. And so the chainmen would throw down the chains and say they weren't going out in the morning until they took care of these cats, you know, and they'd have to spend a whole day hunting down these cats. Bears, the same thing would happen with bears.
To make that concave on the inside.
Too, you know.
Yeah, Lewis and Clark bubblegum. Now that's
that's special.
We'll have to wait here for me to get my freshly squeezed orange juice. Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, my name is Jim Denny. I live along the Missouri River in a little town about 10 miles south of here on the west side called Lupus, Missouri. I'm also a historian. I work with the Missouri State Park System for 25 years now, and I've spent almost all of that time studying this region and the history of the Missouri River. It's kind of a ruling passion of my life. We're just walking along the Katy Trail right now. We're heading west towards the Katy Railroad Tunnel. It's for a Lewis and Clark buff. It's slightly unfortunate in the sense that they probably blasted away the portions of the bluff containing the pictographs that Lewis and Clark saw when they stopped at this place on June the 7th, 1804. Figures with sort of antlers projecting from their heads, and when Lewis and Clark tried to investigate the pictographs here, they were driven away by what they described as very, V-E-R-R-Y, large rattlesnakes. But nonetheless, they were actually right here, right at this spot, back in 1804 on June the 7th. What you wouldn't give to just see it the way it was before all the changes took place. You know, to go back and just see this place, you know, when there were still mountain lions and black bears and wild Indians, you know, roaming its woods, and back, you know, when the river was just this tremendous body of water that snaked all over the place with thousands of islands. And, you know, we've done great things. You know, we've become a great nation and a great power, but we've destroyed a lot of Edens to do that. And I think there are a lot of us that like to see those lost Edens that were once here.
From the Journals of Lewis and Clark, a composition by Dan Botvich, these are the members of the expedition. The Great Falls Symphony and Choir. Great Falls, Montana is our destination, and we'll get there right after the break on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices on the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home.
Joe and I just pulled into Missouri's Arrow Rock Campground,
where the deer and the antelope play.
That's Farrell Atkins, the campground host.
Where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
When you follow a major river like the Missouri, you're following the course of civilization, trade routes, war parties, settlers.
Home on the Range, one of my favorite songs. Beautiful evening here in Arrow Rock. This is famous for the Lewis and Clark Trail came through here, Arrow Rock here. This whole area was Osage Indians, and the white man came and traded with them for their beautiful pelts. We were told the other night, anything on four legs and maybe some things on two legs, the Indians traded to the fur traders. Then the fur traders gave them steel, tomahawks, knives, and the muskets. And my grandmother was Cherokee. So I have kind of a fond admiration for the Indian. And I guess there were several other tribes around here that wanted to cash in on this trading with the settlers, but the Osage fought off, I don't know how many tribes. They were pretty tough. So then the white man, of course, he says, you know, we kind of like this land. We'd like for you to move off of it. So they were sent out to Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas and continue to trade over there.
The red man was pressed from this part of the West, 'tis unlikely he'll ever return to the banks of Red River
where seldom, if ever, his flickering campfires burn.
Lewis and Clark were army captains on a military expedition to befriend Indian nations. They wintered with the Mandans. Shoshone horses got them across the Rockies. Nez Perce food kept the expedition from starving. On the way back, the army had a good old time camping with Nez Perce. They had contests, horse races, foot races, target shooting.
So there's a really strong tie between the military and the Nez Perce.
That's Matt Novak, Natural Resources Director for Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, the only active-duty army base on the whole Lewis and Clark Trail.
We're standing on Nez Perce Way, actually on Chief Joseph Loop.
One of our first national cemeteries is here, along with the first military prison. And somewhere on the fort, along the Missouri, there's another cemetery and another prison.
In 1877, there was the Nez Perce War. And I'm not going to go into the reasons for that. It's really sad reasons as far as I'm concerned. But the Nez Perce, there were five band leaders. The only two that survived the war were Joseph and Yellow Wolf. And because the children were starving and freezing to death up in Montana, Joseph agreed to surrender to General Miles. Originally, they were supposed to be taken back to their reservation in Idaho, but the Army changed its mind and instead brought them to Fort Leavenworth. They arrived on train just right up here in the bluff area, walked out across the road over here, across the bottomlands, and there was a horse racetrack out there, and they were incarcerated inside that horse racetrack. We also know from the numbers that came in, there was 431 that came in on the train, and there was about 21 that didn't leave. And somewhere out there, probably in the vicinity of the racetrack, is where they were buried. Chief Joseph was, the media really picked up on him because he was a very eloquent speaker. They were very proud people, and they had a very good military history. So there were a lot of visitors that came from Kansas City and Leavenworth to see the Nez Perce. So many, in fact, that the Army had to set up visiting hours for the people to come visit the Nez Perce in order to protect the Nez Perce from being bothered 24/7. It must have been quite a hullabaloo going at that time. Leavenworth had about 50,000 people. It was a far larger city than it is today. In fact, it was the largest city between St. Louis and San Francisco. This was the jumping-off place for the West.
When Lewis and Clark camped with the Nez Perce, there was all kinds of social interaction, sports, and sex. 60 years later, when Chief Joseph surrendered, one of the prisoners was an old blue-eyed, sandy-haired man. The Nez Perce said he was Captain Clark's son. We shape our civilization by meeting new people, also by killing them. The Missouri River has seen plenty of both. The Lewis and Clark Trail is well marked with Lewis and Clark highway signs, Lewis and Clark historical markers, and flanked with Lewis and Clark inns, Lewis and Clark insurance, Lewis and Clark estates. By the time we get to Omaha, we're about sick of Lewis and Clark and glad to be among some people who'd never heard of them.
Lewis and Clark? I've never been to Lewis and Clark. Yeah, Lewis and Clark is a junior high school here in Omaha.
They were explorers, you know.
Oh, no, I had never heard of them. Not that Lewis and Clark I never heard of.
I'll tell you what we're doing. Me and a buddy are traveling the Lewis and Clark Trail, the Missouri River.
Missouri River.
And then we just talk to people along the way, you know.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Interviewing people, getting their general ideas about different states where you've never been before and what's going on, what's the nightlife like and stuff like that. Yeah, you need to know these things.
I'm Shetty from Madras, India. I came here to see my children. They are working here. You are from which place?
I'm from Montana, which is way north of here, Montana.
Montana?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I am following the Missouri River, a trail called the Lewis and Clark Trail. Lewis and Clark were two explorers who came through in the 1800s. Never heard of them.
Explorer, I know.
In India, did you have some famous explorers?
Yeah, not explorers. What is that called? The saints. Saints. They wrote about the Hindu religion.
Did they travel, these people?
Yeah, they traveled long.
Where would they go? What would they do?
They go to forest and you heard about Lord Buddha? Buddha?
Yes, I have.
Siddhartha. He was a big king's son. But he renounced everything, went to big forest and meditated, got enlightened, and he taught Buddhism. Not hurt anybody, not offend anybody, and People are like brothers and sisters.
Do you practice Buddhism?
No, we are Hindus. We have got our own temples. We worship Lord Krishna, Rama, Vishnu, Shiva.
Do the Hindus and the Buddhists get along?
Get along, no problem. No harm at all. They're just like brothers and sisters. No quarrel, nothing.
Every state we've been in so far was named for an Indian nation. Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, the Dakotas. From now on, half our journey will be through reservations. At Fort Randall Casino, we hear a powwow outside. It's the second one we passed that day. They feed us fry bread and buffalo stew in a lot of ways, just like Lewis and Clark's time. This is still Indian country. Lewis and Clark gathered information from almost 50 different tribes on their journey. The first Native American we interview has a Maine accent.
I'm paddling the river in a canoe. I started at the headwaters on May 10th in Three Forks, Montana, and I've covered over 1,300 miles in this short period of time. I'm a little over halfway to St. Louis. And then I turn northeast to head up to the Great Lakes and on into Canada. And go down to Maine. That's where I'm from, and that's where I'm trying to get back to before freeze up. I'm Neil Phillips, and I'm a Penobscot Indian Nation member, and I'm from Indian Island, Maine, which is in the city of Old Town, right on the Penobscot River. That's where I grew up, and I'm still there. We didn't have a bridge to our reservation village until 1950, so I was a teenager when that bridge was built. People ask me, so when did you first start paddling? I don't know. Maybe I was such a small child, you know, because that was the only way that you had to travel between, you know, the city and village. Canoes were always part of my life, and I've been a canoe racer for many, many years, whitewater and flatwater both. I left the Canadian border last year and ended up at the Mexican border right down the coast. It took me 7 months and 2 days in a canoe. And then while I was paddling, I was thinking about, you know, what's the longest river in this country? Missouri. Everybody thinks it's the Mississippi. The Mississippi's the biggest. But it's not the longest. Missouri is the longest. And Montana has to be the most beautiful state I think I've ever paddled in. It is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you're traveling at between, you know, 4 or 5 miles an hour, so you see everything. Bighorn sheep, mountain goats, elk, white-tailed deer, mule deer, and all the other small animals that's along the rivers. And it's so nice to get out and use your body. Sure, you hurt. Like right now, I know there's something coming because I was hurting just walking right down this morning. You know, weather, I feel that because I broke my back many years ago. And this was a military wound, and I've had shoulder operations from paddling. So, you know, all of those things bother me, but you can't let them stop you. Sure, they hurt. You know, you got to take ibuprofen or something like that, and that's about as much as I take. But you just keep pushing, because someday it's all going to fall apart. And I realize that.
Fast line, Joel, goes right down there in the flight. Right.
I can see it down here.
Yeah, and it goes right through the trees. And it goes over that little flat there, and then it cuts across.
We've been pedaling hard the last few days to get here by Joe's birthday. This is where he grew up.
And here's that first fence that we come in over here.
And that's Joe's dad, Joe Verbanek Sr.
But there used to be a home site up here on the flat to the north of us.
He's walking us around some land he inherited here on the Standing Rock Reservation, which straddles North and South Dakota. Joe and his dad are both part Sioux.
It's a hell of a good hunting area. You know, for deer hunting and stuff like that.
On one of Captain Lewis's birthdays on the trail, he wrote this into his journals. August 18th, 1805. This day, I completed my 31st year, and I conceived that I had, in all probability, now existed about half the period which I am to remain in this sublunary world. I reflected that I had, as yet, done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race, or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. Your thoughts tend to drift when you're outside a lot. On a long journey, you never know when you're going to eat or where you're going to sleep. But you do know one thing, and that's that every day you'll wake up with the same one goal: to move yourself a little further down the trail. And that can be addicting. Motion gives you a clarity of purpose, which you kind of miss when you get back to civilization. Joe and I did. I think Meriwether Lewis did too. A few months after his return, he was appointed governor of the Louisiana Territory. He drank a lot, ran up some debts, and never got to do what he really wanted, which was publish his journals. In October 1809, Clark wrote his brother with the news. Governor Lewis killed himself. I fear the weight of his mind has overcome him. What will be the consequence? What will become of his papers?
It's a sound that Theodore Roosevelt would have known quite well when he stepped off the train on September 9th, 1883. And you're standing right next to the Maltese Cross Cabin, which was Theodore Roosevelt's first home here in the Badlands. He came out here to hunt bison. When he was a young boy, he had read about stories, and people talked about that there were millions of bison. Some say 50 or 60 million bison on the northern plains. And the fact that it took him 13 days to finally find an animal to shoot, and that was his first lesson that he really learned out here that he took to the White House, that wildlife is disappearing. Elk, the wolf, the plains grizzly, all these animals that were out here by the time he was president, many of them no longer lived here in North Dakota. As a president, he set land aside to protect wildlife, to protect lands. He talks about people understand that it's wantonly destructive to destroy an ancient church or a famous painting, but he said it's also equally destructive to destroy a cliff or a tree or a bird. And those are things that he wrote back then at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. He told people that if it wasn't for his time here in North Dakota, he would not have been president. This was where he learned the ideas of fair play and hard work and the strenuous life, where he would be in the saddle for 24 hours or more chasing after cattle. Some say he was not really much of a cowboy, but he tried to play the part. He tried to dress the part, and he wanted to be one. But if you read his writings, he's always referring to riding up from the water's edge up to the top of a plateau and talking about the silence here and the clear skies. Because back then, they were already having a lot of pollution within New York. In this cabin, he wrote a speech in 1886 where he said, "We as a nation have to come to grips with conservation. We have to protect things for our children's children." These are his very words. "It's not what we have that will make us a great nation. It is the way in which we use it," which was sort of sums up all of his ideas.
Bruce Kay, ranger at Teddy Roosevelt National Park. We've crossed from North Dakota to Montana, from the Badlands to the Missouri Breaks, and we're not the only ones following the Lewis and Clark Trail.
These are the reenactors coming in.
We've been on the Flambeau River in Wisconsin and Lake Superior up to Fort William. And
Jed Cottingham.
We've been down through here, I don't know, four or five times the last 12, 13 years. We can go French and Indian War, and everybody's kind of Lewis and Clark right now. I've got handmade wool stockings, handmade linen pants here, little quill work on a tobacco pouch. All of our food is primitive, jerky, smoked bacon, lied corn, which most people call hominy. Flint and steel fires, no matches. And we have a rum box that we carry our shrub in. It's a Hudson Bay mixed shrub. When the guys were on the rivers in Canada, the voyageurs, they wanted their rum ration every day, but they wouldn't eat any vegetables and stuff that would keep them from getting scurvy. So what they do is they would mix the rum with Muscovado sugar, which is like a real dark brown molasses sugar, and then they put lime juice in it. So when the guys got their ration of rum, they got their lime juice too. That way they wouldn't get scurvy.
You guys gotta talk to the captain.
But it's just fun. Just test. You make all this stuff, and you go out and test your gear and test your skills with the gear. That's stuff that they would have used, you know. Like this knife I'm carrying. This knife is modern made in Sheffield, England. This same knife has been in continuous production for over 225 years. Fishermen use it today, commercial fishermen. They take it to the Amazon and to trading stores. And Amazonian Indians are using this. They use it in Africa. Use them all over the world. And they were using them here when this was the frontier. And Fort Union, just down here in Fort Benton, this is one of the knives that they sold.
Yeah.
So, you know, people like American history. Well, this is it. You got to rough it a little bit. You got to be willing to be in the mud and the dirt a little bit. And, you
know. Well, we're doing pretty good. It'd be nice to have a little rain to cool things, huh?
You like to create, in your mind, romanticize about it, you know. And we do that. People look back and think that it might be better. But every generation thinks that about a couple of generations back or so, and it's a lie. They had as much government regulation on these rivers and permits and stuff as they do today. I mean, you know, so politics was just as dirty. You couldn't haul liquor up to the Indians, and they actually had, you know, people checking to make sure you didn't have liquor. And so we think a lot of things we do are so new, and it's really not, except the technology. You know, as far as human beings, they've been the same for 100,000 years, you know, 100 and some thousand years, yeah. Humans are humans.
We're at a location that, based on the journals of Lewis and Clark, we're at the campsite that they established on the 16th of June, 1805. My name is Ken Karsmiski, and I'm the Associate Curator of History and Historical Archaeology at the Museum of the Rockies at Montana State University. And what we're looking at is a half-mile stretch of Missouri River. As a crow flies, about 10 miles away from Great Falls, Montana, Lewis and Clark were able to see the Great Falls in 1805, and they had to move around them with probably as much as 30 tons of equipment and 33 guys. It took them a month to do that. The Lewis and Clark expedition, from the time they left St. Louis, they're out for 863 days. They make over 600 camps. This is the only place where we have enough evidence to say this is it. We have found it. And knowing that this rock right here and this one, I mean, I'm kneeling down here at the side of a campfire that they knelt at. And even as exciting is that I know that I can walk 50 feet away from here and kneel at another campfire that they built, and then walk 50 feet away from that and kneel at another campfire that they built. And when I started this, the thing that I heard more than anything else was, you're not going to find anything. These guys didn't leave anything behind. And my response was, then how did they pick up their fires and take them with them? Just to the east of us is a 3-acre field. With a magnetometer, three of us can survey that field in 6 days, and we can show you most of the fires that are going to be out there in that 3 acres. If you take this trowel, and those same three people are scraping, they're going to scrape for 214 years to cover 3 acres. We have found 18 campfires. 15 of those date back thousands of years. But the three fires dating to Lewis and Clark's period are really a key. And then as we work around those fires, we found some other things. In all, we have over 9,000 pieces of bone that we've collected. Within 15 feet of where we're standing, we have essentially a butchering site. And we've radiocarbon dated the bone, and we're coming up with 1810 plus or minus 50. We found a gun flint. We found an iron push pin. Imagine yourself being Clark, and you can see it in the journals. What he's doing is he's completing the maps of the Missouri River. He's sitting out here. He's totally exposed to the wind. He just puts a push pin in each corner of that paper, and it holds it down. When you're out here, and we experience it as an archaeological team, if it rains, you're wet. You know, if the bugs bite, well, you've got welts all over you. If it hails, you've got bruises. If it's 100 degrees, you're hot. That's the same way with them, and they were planning for it. They've got a field kitchen. They've got portable desks. They've got push pins to keep their paper down. You know, so everything they think about, and they allow for that. It's an incredible journey. Most people say it's the Great American Odyssey. This is a group of people who are out in the most forbidding country that they can imagine at their time with virtually no knowledge. For me, it is really understanding history from a different perspective. And a part of it is also being a part of history. When Lewis and Clark were on their expedition, and they had gotten as far as the Mandan villages, and they were about to set out in the spring of 1805, Lewis took the time to write back to Jefferson and let Jefferson know what was happening. But he also commented that they were about to set off on the real exploration and likened himself to Columbus. Lewis likened himself to Columbus. This is a moment in world history that I'm taking a part in, is what Lewis was saying. And I think that that's a part of what I feel, you know, in those reflective times, is that this is a part of history that I was lucky enough to take part in. I could fit the pieces together. I could come up with something tangible that has to do with Lewis and Clark. And that's really pretty satisfying.
I think if you're going to use historical subject matter, you have to find music that's contained in there. And I can't, it's a real abstract concept. It's music that might be hidden in there in some way, some word combination, something hidden in that material itself that could provide some music.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River.
The readings are taken from Jefferson's instructions to Lewis, influenced by, of all things, Philip Glass and Einstein on the beach. There's some wonderful moments in there of readings. And I liked that potential of giving more information, but being able to make it music at the same time.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River.
The object
River
of your mission
in order
is
to determine which
Missouri River. In order
might
to determine
the most direct
which course
and practical
might
water
offer the most direct
across this
and
continent
practical
to the Pacific Ocean.
Across this continent to the Pacific Ocean.
Like all composers, I stole ideas. There's a concept that goes back to the Renaissance that's maybe most used by a composer named Ravel. He would overlay the musical alphabet with the written alphabet. So A would equal the pitch A and B equals B, all the way through G, the seven notes of the musical alphabet. And then when he got to H, he'd start over again, and H would be an A, I would be a B. And so it occurred to me that the most distinctive thing about the journals of Lewis and Clark is their spelling. In fact, in my readings of them, I found 29 ways that William Clark spelled the word Sioux. So I just applied Ravel's musical alphabet to that to see what I ended up with. And oddly enough, I ended up with something that sounds kind of cliche. I immediately wanted to avoid doing that melodically, and I put them harmonically. And that was one sound that for me kind of has a coldness and an emptiness. And then maybe playing everything at the same time, come up with something that might serve as a theme. And there's one movement in this piece where the choir spells all 29 different spellings of the word Sioux. Final movement is called Each One's Preference Was Recorded, referring to the vote that was taken over on the coast as to where they should spend the winter. As my grandfather used to say, one of the defining moments in the history of democracy where everybody actually had a say.
Clark, John,
occurred to me that maybe one of the more emotional things you could do would be to simply recite the names of all the people who went on this expedition. Many of them kind of faded into obscurity and went off to do who knows what. And so here's 200 years later, 200 people are sitting in a hall in Great Falls, Montana, not really far from where they hauled their boats. I mean, it's a weird thing. And they're intoning these names. And I was wondering if the real lesson, this subconscious thing that's encouraging about it, is that you never know the importance of what you do. You don't know what it's going to be.
Dan Buckfitch talking about his composition from the Journals of Lewis and Clark. I'm Barrett Golding, and there's lots of Lewis and Clark links at our site, hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.